There are two or three paragraphs here that we already did, but I'm going to be reading and explaining because we have to cover a lot of ground, and the best way to do it is by seeing what the Kuzi has to say. The king wants to know, describe to me the religious God-fearing personality. Describe to me what he's like. Because the Talmud Chacham had already told him that as far as Torah is concerned, we don't go for being hermits, we don't hide out, we don't cause ourselves bodily harm or deprivation. So he wants to know what is unique, what's special, what makes up this religious personality. Give me a description of the doings of one of your pious men at the present time. And then he gives him the cryptic response, in which he says, in number three, a pious man is, so to speak, the guardian of his country, who gives to its inhabitants provisions and all they need. He is so just that he wrongs no one, nor does he grant anyone more than is due. Then, when he requires them, he finds them obedient to his call. All of his subjects are going to be ready to do his bidding. He orders, and they execute. He forbids, and they abstain. So, of course, the king asks him, I asked thee concerning the pious man, not a prince. I didn't ask you, you're describing to me a head of state. I'm talking about, just tell me, what's a good day yid? What's a fome yid? So the Talmud Chacham, the rabbi, says the following. The pious man is in fact like a prince who rules. What does he rule over? He rules over his thoughts, his feelings, his passions, his ideas. He has made of himself an absolutely amazing emotional, intellectual, and religious machine. In other words, he has all of his faculties and all of the facilities of his mind and his body are ready to do his bidding. And he makes sure that each one receives what they require, as though they would be members of his community, members, subjects of his. He makes sure that there's a balance. Everything has to be balanced. And by the way, that's one of the most unusual things about Yahdut. In religion, there's the idea of balance. There are no feelings or needs that Torah simply does not pay attention to. Every need of the human being has to be fulfilled, but everything has to be within measure. Everything has to be done according to the requirements of halacha. The pious man is nothing but a prince. The saintly person is a leader. All of his senses and his attributes, both spiritual and physical, submit themselves to his command, which he governs corporeally, as it is written, he that rules his spirit is better than he that taketh the city. A Kobesh Yitzro, Shlomo HaMelech says, is greater than one who conquers a city. Because for a human being to be able to conquer and hold in check his own passions may very well at times be, take even greater strength than it is for one to conquer a city. He is fit to rule because if he were the prince of a country, he would be as just as he is to body and soul. We're talking about a human being that's going to take very, very good care of his bodily needs. He's going to take very good care of his spiritual and his emotional needs. That's what the pious man is. He subdues his passions, keeping them in bounds, but giving them their share in order to satisfy them with regard to food, to drink, to cleanliness. He further subdues the desire for power, but allows them as much expansion as avails them for the discussion of scientific or mundane views, as well as to warn the evil-minded.
very heavy, very heavy what he's saying. All right, I complain about it every week or so. So what? You're used to it already. What he's saying is the following. Yes, we need, there are times that we need power. We need to express some kind of strength. So he says that expression of strength has different outlets. The outlet is not by subduing other people, but it means that he also muzzles aggressive tendencies which seek to vanquish other people. He feeds these tendencies they do in a productive fashion by defeating others in scholarly and philosophical debates. That's what he was saying here. Now, there's a sense, is it competition and power that we need? Competition and power can also express themselves intellectually. The intellectual debate, the idea of power can also express itself through a mitzvah in Torah, and that mitzvah is to admonish others. You lost? Oh, you're okay. Good. He feeds his senses their due by using them for productive purposes. Let me see how. Let's see, page 138. So he says he allows the senses their share according as he requires them for the use of hands, feet, and tongue as necessity or desire arise. The same is the case with hearing, seeing, and the kindred sensations which succeed them: imagination, conception, thought, memory, and willpower, which command one's seeing. He trains all of his faculties, and he trains all of his faculties that they should be used in a positive way. He does not allow any of these limbs or faculties to go beyond their special task or encroach upon another. And if you take the example, I don't know if you do exercise. You can exercise one part of the body, and what happens if there isn't sufficient balance, you're going to lose at some other part of the body. Any kind of exercise you do, you exercise one arm, you have to exercise the other arm. You exercise one leg, you have to exercise the other leg. There has to be a sense of balance, because in the event that you're going to overemphasize one part of the body or one faculty, you are of necessity going to weaken or remove from other faculties of the body. If he then has satisfied each of them, giving to the vital organs the necessary amount of rest and sleep, and to the physical ones, waking, movements, and worldly occupation, he's very clear. He says it has to be, you know, all, what is it? All work and no play makes somebody or other a dull boy. All right? Makes who? Jack, a dull boy. The idea that he's expressing here is the necessity for balance. There has to be, we call it izun, that there is a balance of all of the mental faculties, all of the physical faculties. A person has to walk, he has to talk, he has to study, he has to work, he has to rest, he has to sleep. All of these together make up the total and complete human being. He calls upon his community. By now you know already what the community is. The community he's talking about are all of the faculties, physical and mental faculties of the body. If he trains them all and trains them well and maintains the delicate balance that's needed both in the realm of the physical and the spiritual, then when the moment of need arises and he calls upon them, they are going to serve him faithfully as a subject would serve a prince. He calls upon his community as a respected prince calls his disciplined army to assist him in reaching the higher or divine degree which is to be found above the degree of the intellect. He sees the realm of the religious as above the realm of intellect. And this is what he's been saying from the very beginning. Yes, there were the Aristotles and there were the Platos, but Chachma Yisrael were higher than them. The holy man, but the main point he wants to let go is the holy man, in addition to being balanced, he lives in this world. He does not in any way separate himself from the world. As in the introduction, at the beginning of this third essay, he said, and he may repeat it again, the idea that those who go off on their own to meditate and sort of separate themselves from this world, ultimately the point that they're going to reach is going to be a point where they're going to despise life itself. Because we're social beings. We need people. Sometimes we may think that we don't, but we need people. And not only we need people, we need to be able to exercise all the faculties of body and mind in all sorts of different areas. You can't simply take yourself off, go off somewhere, and shut out the whole world. Ultimately, what one will reach is the point where he despises this world. Goes on to say, he arranges his community in the same manner as Moses arranged his people around Mount Sinai. He orders his willpower to receive every command issued by him obediently and to carry it out forthwith. You think of something, so now there's a thought, there's will, and then there's action. The person who has trained himself will be able to do all of these steps in a sense without even thinking about it. It's going to come naturally. They say about Avram Avinu that Avram Avinu, the Malach tells him, the angel tells him, as he's ready to slaughter Yitzchak on the Akedah, it says, Al tishlach yodecha el hanar. Don't send your hand against the boy. That's a strange thing. You should have told him, don't slaughter him. Don't harm him. Avraham Avinu had made of himself such an incredible spiritual machine. The moment he had decided on something, it's as though he's sending a message to his hand, and his hand is going to move. Al tishlach, don't send your hand. Stop it right here. Because if the instruction is going to come from here, it's going to go straight to his hand. He makes faculties and limbs do his bidding without contradiction, forbids them evil inclinations of mind and fancy, forbids them to listen to or believe in them, until he has taken counsel with the intellect. Before he believes something that he hears, or something that he sees, or something that he reads, he's going to analyze it very, very carefully. Analyze it very carefully. The fact is that it's terribly frightening. I always like to use a current example. The same material that was available to many mazuz was available to Edna Arbel and her staff. Same material. The same material. And the two of them saw it and interpreted it and acted in diametrically opposed ways. Now, the truth is, I have to say the truth, I was waiting for Sharon to get the works. But there's only one other person that I wanted to get the works even more, and that's Edna Arbel. Understand? But it's amazing. There is not one new bit of material that became available to the Yoetz HaMishpati. All the same material. And he saw it in such a different way. Because everything has to be weighed by the intellect. Do you understand? This happens to be one of the fundamental principles of Yahdut. That in order to be truly objective, first of all, I remember once discussing this with a priest. True objectivity is not merely rare. It's non-existent to be truly objective, except for, there are exceptions. The exceptions are true Gedola Yisrael, saintly individuals, are the ones who at least have to have reached a point where they can be as close as possible for a human being to get to true objectivity. Fact is that what we saw yesterday and what the whole country is going to be debating very excitedly for about 48 hours. Because that's the life expectancy of big news in this country. It has the shortest life expectancy any place in the world. The biggest news lasts over here. And even 48 hours, I'll tell you the truth, is I felt bad. And if they would tell you 3 hours after a pigua, everything's been cleaned away, washed away the blood, the body parts are gone, they've taken the bus, gone, finished. I don't know. I would have thought that maybe it shouldn't be taken away that quickly. We move quickly from one thing to the next. But what's going to be debated is what happened to objectivity. By the way, how are we to know who's the truly objective one of the two? Maybe this Edna Ardale, whom I dislike intensely for a lot of reasons, maybe she was looking at it truthfully. Maybe Manny Mazuz wants to keep his job. Maybe he's one of those who wants to make sure that the plan is going to go through, and we can't have the upheaval now of a prime minister who's going to be indicted. The truth is, I don't know what the truth is anymore. That's the problem. An agenda. The chassid, the pious individual that Rav Yehuda HaLevi is talking about is one whose agenda is the will of God. Torah is his agenda. And therefore, whatever he hears and whatever he's confronted with, he is going to weigh it and measure it intellectually. What kind of an intellect? An intellect that is suffused with Torah. That's how he's going to look at it. That makes a big difference. That makes a big difference. Yes. It's honest and it's legitimate, and it leaves us in the position that we have to weigh and measure. But one thing we never suspect the Rambam of, that he's got a personal interest over here. We've never suspected of the Rambam that he may make a buck if he is going to pass in such and such. His objective view is this way, and somebody else's objective view is that way, and about that the Gemara says there are times, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim, both are the words of the living God. You can't say that that's true when we are dealing with human beings that may have tremendous pressures of all sorts being brought to bear on them. And this morning I thought, yesterday I haven't done this in years. I listened, I happened to be home, and I turned on the radio, and I listened for the whole 35, 40 minutes The man was so unbelievably convincing that there's absolutely nothing to indict the Prime Minister about. I was convinced that Gilad Sharon is such a talented individual, David Duduapel wasn't even paying him enough for the work that he did. It's amazing. It's amazing. And you listen to it, you know what, it's very frightening. To me, this is frightening. It means that, you know, there can be two views out there, and you know what? It may even be that they are not objective. That's why there's an appeals clause. But the point that I want to make, Sarah Roth, the point that I want to make is that the machlokes between the Rambam and the Rambam does not fall into the category. It's light years away from the machlokes between Edna and Manny. That's the point that I want to make. Because the machlokes of Manny and Edna, which may be couched in all sorts of intellectual and legal terminology, there's still the doubt. He just has this doubt that maybe there are other interests involved over here. It's pretty scary. Because, I don't know, we were always raised to believe that, you know, the Supreme Court, you know, justices, we were raised on who? Learned Hand, Brandeis, Frankfurter. Yeah. You know what? It's because it wasn't in our lifetime, so we looked at them as the great jurors. Maybe they also had an agenda. Maybe they also had an agenda. But over here, there are such clear agendas. Anyway, that's the point that I wanted to make. A machlokes between the Rambam and the Ramban is not like this machlokes. Of course, it costs its Torah. No. They do certainly want to leave the impression that what they're doing is they're looking for justice. They're looking for truth, the pursuit of justice and truth. But we know, and everybody knows, it's so obvious that there are all of these pressures that are being brought on them. The chassid is the one who must be able to judge between conflicting interests within himself. That's a pretty difficult thing to do. Let's go further. He makes faculties and limbs do his bidding without contradiction, forbids them evil inclinations of mind and fancy. What he's talking about, lo toturu acharei levadchem v'acharei einechem. Do you understand? When Torah says there's a mitzvah of not turning after your eyes and your heart, do you know what a difficult commandment that is to fulfill? It means that it requires training that may take a lifetime. And where, how do you get that training? That, of course, has been one of the great debates, I'd say, of the last 100 years in the Jewish community. How does one train oneself? Does one have to go through specific exercises in order to train the different faculties of the human personality? That was the, I would say that was the contribution or the chidush of the Musa movement. The Musa movement that started in the yeshivas in Eastern Europe at the end or towards the last half of the 19th century, beginning with Rabbi Saul Salanter, and following afterwards with all of the great the Alta from Slobodka, all of the great luminaries of the Musa world, and the Musa movement is that which exists until today in Yeshivot. What was the Musa movement? The Musa movement basically said the following. Normally, we would expect that from whatever one studies, there should be transfer of training. Right, let me use a little fancy terminology. What's transfer of training? Transfer of training is when you educate somebody and you give them book knowledge, they should be able to turn the book knowledge into something that trains them emotionally, spiritually. In other words, ideas that one imbibes into one's mind should impact on one's conduct. If you learn all the halachas of kabedet avicha v'imecha, honor your father and mother, it should therefore make you one who honors father and mother. If you learn all of the halachas about honesty, that's good. The halachas of honesty, of possession, what is permitted, what's prohibited, that, it would seem, should automatically make you one who's going to be honest and is going to be concerned about somebody else's money or somebody else's property. What Rabbi Yisrael Salanter found was this transfer of training didn't necessarily take place. So what he said was that we have to move in a different direction, and the direction is we have to realize that we have this weakness, and therefore we have to take each character trait and work on it. We always thought that Torah makes a person a mensch. It may not necessarily be that way. It may very well be that when Torah was learned the way Torah should be studied, L'shem Shamayim, that Torah impacted on the entire personality of the individual. But it hasn't been so for a long time. So along came Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and said, but you know what we have to do? We have to, in fact, take different faculties and abilities and do exercises, spiritual exercises, in order to develop these faculties. One of the classic ones was the repetition of certain mantras. I think it's the Rosh Chabad Asher that wrote, one should stay away from pride as far as one can. And a true Musa student would say it over and over again. By the way, it just doesn't work. It's just not going to work. It has to be l'hischachek m'hakayze b'tachlis ha'ichot. And you say it, and you say it, and you say it, and think about it, and mean it, until you reach the point where you have this feeling that pride is ugly. And I'm going to stay away. It can take years, by the way. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter himself said that a natural bent or inclination might necessarily take a lifetime. You know, we're just not optimistic enough when we have this feeling that people never change. Sometimes when I get this feeling that people never change, it's a very unhappy kind of feeling. We should always be in the process of change and the process of growth. That's what a whole lifetime is supposed to be. If we're honest enough with ourselves, we know precisely those aspects of our personality that require correction or have to become more balanced, and we have to work on it, and we should work on it. To say that you can't change, I don't know. I'm afraid to look at myself sometimes in the dark of night, but I will not confess to anything now. That was the Muslim movement. The Chazon Ish said, and I think the Chazon Ish is going to be more significant in our understanding of the Chosid here. The Chazon Ish, it would seem, was not in favor of the exercises of the Muslim movement. What the Chazon Ish said, if you're just going to fulfill the halacha, the mitzvah, as the Shulchan Aruch tells you, that in and of itself is the greatest training ground of all. It means, you know, I can't be lazy, I have to get up in the morning, I have to daven. There are mitzvahs that require effort and energy, I have to be on the move. There are mitzvahs that require kavana, I have to daven with kavana. I have to say Kriyat Shema with kavana. I have to have in mind to fulfill mitzvahs. There are so many mitzvahs, and to fulfill all of these mitzvahs, and by the way, you're going to see that's exactly what Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to say. All of the various mitzvahs are really that which train different aspects of our personality in order to create the totally healthy spiritual individual. And that's what he's going to say is the chassid. Interesting that in the world of Musa there were two completely different approaches. There was the approach of Slabatka, which was the approach of Gadlus HaAdam. What was the greatness of man? Slabatka, they convince you that you're God's gift to mankind. And you had to convince yourself that you're God's gift to mankind. And if that's what you are, you better act like it. When I came to Yeshiva, I learned in 55, I learned in Chevron Yeshiva. Chevron Yeshiva, not the Yeshiva in Chevron. But Chevron Yeshiva was in Geula, number 10, Rechov HaYeshiva, Rechov Chagai. So I began to find out about fellows in the dormitory. One of them had 40 white shirts and 20 schnitzen. You know what a schnitzen is? A tie. And you have to have two or three Borsellino hats. I don't know how they afforded it then. And until somebody explained to me that a Ben Torah, when he walks out, has to be absolutely immaculate, spotless, so that when you take a look at him, you see that this is a person of substance. There was a complete opposite approach, which was the approach of Navardic. Navardic was the approach that man, I see, you know everything, I'm going all the way back there. You came from a home of Bali Musa, your father learned in Navardic. In Navardic, what it was precisely the opposite. You're nothing. You're lower than a worm. You're garnished. You, nothing, are going to dare defy the word of God? What are you talking about? Shuffle around the world until the end of days, but don't dare do anything against God's will. I once wanted to explain that these two approaches are two Mishnayot in Pirkei Avot. Atavya ben Mahalalel says, Da me'ayin vasa ula'onat ha'olech. You know where you should come from, and you know where you're going to end up, and you have to know before whom you're going to have to give din v'cheshbon judgment. What is he expressing? He's expressing the idea, you're small, you're infinitesimal, you're nothing. You're going to end up as dust of the earth, and you're going to have to stand up before the great divine being, God himself, for judgment. Rabbi Akiva, not like Akavya, Rabbi Akiva says, Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem, man is beloved because he's created in the image of God. Chavivin Yisrael, Israel is even more beloved, Shenikru Banim Lamokim, they are called God's children. Chaviv in Yisrael, he also says, Israel is beloved, Shemitam lehem klei chenda, but because to them were given the most desirous of objects, Torah. Rabbi Akiva looks at the greatness of the Jewish people. By the way, at the same time that he also expresses the greatness of every human being. Chaviv Adam, beloved is man, that he was created in the image of God. Yisrael also are those who are called Banim Lamakom, children of God, and the ones to whom were given this great gift, which is Torah. Akavya looks at man as nothing. Akiva looks at man as the Jew, as something great. I always have the feeling, of course, that the truth is somewhere in the middle. We even need a balance between Akavya and Akiva. There are moments at which person has to be reminded or has to remind himself that he's but a little speck on the face of this earth. But at the same time that he's a little speck, he also has to remind himself that he's capable of making a major contribution. The two faces of man.
Oh, we gotta move.
If he permits, they can obey him,
but not otherwise. In other words, if he permits his faculties something, then they will be able to obey him. But if he does not permit them, in other words, he is the master of his faculties. In this way, his willpower receives its orders from him, carrying them out accordingly. For man to be master of his own willpower, unbelievable. He directs the organs of thought and imagination, relieving them of all worldly ideas mentioned above, charges his imagination to produce, with the assistance of memory, the most splendid pictures possible in order to resemble the divine things sought after. You know what he's saying?
A human being can take his mind. Imagine that the mind is a camera, a digital camera. We're not...
Who was it that once...
What did I say? Digital camera. What was this great word that somebody said? Ah, he has a photographic memory. There's no film.
He ain't got no film. That's about the great genius to understand who's a sickle nut. He has a photographic memory, but there's no film. Right.
But now when we're talking about digital cameras, of course, are built in. Everything is in there. I think we can talk about man's imagination as a digital camera that has to take pictures. Now, the mind can take all sorts of pictures and store them. And then, like a computer, you bring up those images again. Now, there are all sorts of ugly images that we can store. And then there are beautiful images that we store. So he says, for example, when Torah says that you should never forget having been at Sinai. You know what that is? That tells the mind the following. But we weren't there. Yes, I know your neshama was there. We all met there. I know about that. But when there's a mitzvah in Torah that says you're supposed to remember Mount at Har Sinai, do you know what the mind is supposed to do? We've seen mountains, so we know what a mountain is. We've seen crowds of people, so we know what crowds of people are. We're supposed to take those two images and superimpose them one upon the other until we create in our own mind a picture of what Mount Har Sinai was. And we have to lock that into our mind and we have to refresh it. Such pictures are the scenes of Sinai. Abraham and Isaac on Moriah. So you know what? I'll tell you when I read this, I think I was right. No. Remember, people used to ask me, should they go see the Ten Commandments, the movie? Dathan is Edward G. Robinson, you understand? So I told people, you should not go to see that movie, or any movies like it. The last time I was asked to Shiloh was about the Prince of Egypt, you understand? So I said to them, I have a picture in my mind of what Moshe Rabbeinu looked like. It's most probably some picture that I have in my mind of a Zayda with a flowing white beard, with callous and filling. I don't want any image to infringe on the holiness of that image. I should walk around the whole life with Charlton Heston. This says Machmach. Or do I have to walk around with an animated image of the Prince of Egypt, Moshe? He's describing over here how you're supposed to create the mental pictures that should inhabit your mind. The mind is an unbelievable piece of equipment. You have to keep it clean. It's not easy in our days to keep the mind clean. It certainly is difficult in our days to be able to focus in and take pictures that we want that should remain in our mind. But Rav Yehuda Halevi is talking about the chassid. The chassid has already trained all of his faculties to do his bidding. He's going to see a mountain, and he's going to see a crowd of people, and he's going to put together a mountain, crowd of people, God descending upon the mountain and giving Torah. We all have a picture in our mind of Avram at the Akeda. By the way, I did see one picture of Avram at the Akeda. Rembrandt in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. Awesome. It did not upset or invade any picture that I had in my mind. It's an awesome piece of art. It did not in any way remove, on the contrary, I think it expresses the greatness of Avraham Avinu. There are good pictures and there are bad pictures. The tabernacle of Moses, the temple service, the presence of God in the temple and the like. There are all sorts of pictures that we have to walk around with in our minds. He then orders his memory, you see, the digital camera is working. First he has to create the image. And then after he has created the image, he has to put it into the memory. He then orders his memory to retain all these and not to forget them. He warns his sensei and its sinful prompters not to confuse the truth or to trouble it by doubts. There are all sorts of other images that may invade the precincts of our neshama and our mind, and he makes sure we can't help it. There are things we see, there are things that we think about, we have to remove them. He warns his irascibility and greed not to influence or lead astray, nor to take hold of his will, nor subdue it with wrath and lust. Man has to be able to control his emotions. As soon as harmony is restored, his willpower stimulates all his organs to obey it with alertness, pleasure, and joy. What comes to mind is a famous essay of Rav Tesla, where Rav Tesla says, that basically all of life is like a battlefield. There's a struggle that goes on within ourselves. And at every point in life, there's something else that we struggle about. Let's say if the battle is, this is the point of struggle. There are forces on one side, forces on the other. This is me on this side. It may take a while until I conquer and am victorious in that battle. Then the line of battle moves elsewhere. What does he mean by this? He says there are those of us that the struggle is a struggle of Shmirah Shabbos, depending on where we were raised, where we were born. And then for years there may be a struggle over Shmirah Shabbos. And when that battle is won, the mind and the heart moves to the next battleground. The next battleground can be Kashrus. And we take care of that. For most of us, the battle becomes a battle of Well, Lashon Hara always remains an extremely difficult battleground. Now, of course, there are those who simply give up and say, I'll never make it. That's it. I'm going to have to live with that sin. Then there are others who say, no. I can at least diminish the intensity of the sin. Or for that matter, if you want to talk Lashon Hara, so what you do is you find a kosher outlet for it. There are enough people that it's a mitzvah to talk Lashon Hara about. But I'm not going to give you a list right now. But that's always what has to be. All right, Saddam Hussein. Okay. You thought I was going to say Edna or Balin, Yossi Balin, and you were wrong. You were wrong. Chas v'shalom. I love all Jews. Then there are those of us who have to work on truth. You understand? But at every stage of life, the chassid, I'm using Rav Dessler in order to explain what Rav Yehuda Levi is saying about the chassid. The chassid is always locked in struggle. But hopefully the struggle moves from stage to stage. What he struggled about 50 years ago, he doesn't struggle about anymore. That's become second nature already. He's now struggling about making maximum use of his time, maximum use of his faculties. The battle, the struggle is a completely different one than the struggle of years ago. That's most probably true by all of us. The only thing is, you can't stop the struggle. The struggle has to go on. By the way, the only way to keep the struggle going is by study of Torah. You come to Shir, you hear something, you think of something, this is something I have to work on. Truth and falsehood, I think we've overcome that, because whenever we say a lie, it's because we've justified it fully, that it was a mitzvah anyway, so we don't have a problem with that. But we have to be able to judge. We have to be able to use judgment. And the most important thing is to be able to achieve objective judgment. That's so difficult. As soon as harmony is restored, all right, and then all of his organs are going to obey with alertness, pleasure, and joy. As a person trains oneself in the fulfillment of a mitzvah, that mitzvah becomes relatively easy for him to fulfill. Then you go to the next one. There's always a mitzvah. He's going to talk about davening with kavana. I mean, we're going to go through, in the next 2 weeks, most probably, he's going to include in this part of the essay nearly all the mitzvahs of Torah. We're going to have a crash course in all of the mitzvahs of Torah. It's going to be fascinating. I say, first of all, using the Chazon Ish, all of the mitzvahs of Torah are the training ground. That's what trains the individual to achieve greater perfection. The Vedas back there. See those people back there? Their grandson davens in my shul. That already says a great deal about him. And he got by mitzvah this way. He got by mitzvah this week. In other words, by mitzvahs now are never a one-day affair. By mitzvahs have become like Sheva Brachos, you understand? There's the party. There's the most probably the putting on still in at the Kotel. They had that. They had one. They had it. And then, of course, there's going to be Shabbos and Shul. And of course, there's going to be the rabbi presenting the young man with his gift. I bought it already. I still have to inscribe it. So I said a word that as well expresses what I want to point out, that life is constantly growth. Growth always involves struggle. Struggle always means pain. No pain, no gain. So here it is. I had this woman last Friday morning. She calls me up. She wants to talk to my wife. My wife is not in. Bela is not available. Okay? So she says, Rabbi,
I want to tell you a verse.
A verse?
Me?
So she tells me the following verse. I'm Parshat Shlach. The Maraglim came back and they said that it's Eretz Ochelet Yosheha, a land that consumes those who live in the land. It sounds like a terrible, terrible thing. It does sound terrible. So the Chidush HaGim, one of the Gedid Ebbets, said, now you know what they meant to say? You can't stand in one place in Eretz Yisrael. You can't live without growth. Yosheha means that those who want to sit around and enjoy life, Eretz Yisrael doesn't let you do that. It's a land that consumes those who just want to sit back and do nothing. Because Eretz Yisrael forces you into the position of continued growth. You have to grow, you have to develop, you have to keep up that struggle. That's exactly what Rav Yehuda HaLevi is saying over here. And I said that's really what Rashi says. Vayeshev Yaakov v'eretz megurei aviv. Yaakov lives in the land where his fathers live. Bikesh Yaakov leishev v'shalva. Yaakov wanted to live in peace. Comes the tragedy of Yosef. The ultimate peace is going to come la'acha me'eves v'mishana. Unfortunately or unfortunately, as long as we hear this struggle, hopefully the struggle should be positive struggle, to be continued.